Now, I'm looking forward to hearing what you've discovered and want to share with us about how to implement the acronym RAIN into your life.
Thanks, Peter. I'm having a little bit of adjustment problems here. Okay. So sorry. Yeah, RAIN is the topic of the day, and I'll give just a little bit of review, past review, for those of you who may not have listened to my previous talks. But in the past, actually the past two talks that I've given here at OIMG have focused on practicing post-meditation investigation, a subject I'm really very interested in and see as an integral part of our overall practice. In September, some of you may remember I reviewed the protocols of Joseph Goldstein, Gil Fronsdale, and Bhante G. And in October, we reviewed the questioning protocol of Shyla Catherine. So we've had some good discussions on this topic of post-meditation investigation. And I'd like to, before I go into RAIN, I'd like to just read a passage from the book that we're studying with Peter in a group this these last 2 months. It's Rodney Smith's book called Stepping Out of Deception. And here's what he has to say about investigation.
Self-deception. Sorry, Leslie, stepping out of self-deception.
You're right, stepping out of self-deception. Thank you. So here's a quote. He talks about investigation throughout the whole thing, but there's one chapter that is really fully, deeply devoted. That's chapter four to investigation. And he says at the end of that chapter, this entire chapter has used the tool of investigation to understand the nature of the self in pain. A key component of awakening is investigation. We see how essential it is to explore pain, regardless of where the examination takes us. Investigation is like a bloodhound that picks up the scent of pain and will not rest until it is completely exposed. Questioning becomes the mechanism for bringing conscious attention into the darkened areas of unconscious. And this engages the heart in the process. It is a tool that can be used anywhere, at any time, toward any experience to open us beyond our ideas and opinions. So that's the end of that last chapter, or that chapter four in Rodney Smith's book. So today, then, I want to continue to explore a version of post-meditation investigation. And this will be the first part of a two-part examination that I'm going to make of the protocol called RAIN. So in December, I'll do the second talk on this, continuing this discussion of the protocol called RAIN, RAIN. It's an acronym. I call it a protocol, although many people refer to RAIN as a meditation. In the Q&A, we can discuss my reasons, or I can tell you about my reasons for not calling it a meditation. I firmly do not call it a meditation. We can talk about that later, though. So a lot of you surely must know about RAIN. It's a very well-known and popular discussed concept or strategy among meditation teachers. It was first coined by Michelle McDonald, a meditation teacher named Michelle McDonald. I think it was the early 2000s. I can't really pin down a specific date on when she started talking and writing about this concept, But since then, since the early 2000s, it has been adapted by many, many mindfulness teachers in the West, most popularly by Tara Brach in her book, Radical Acceptance. Some of you may be familiar with that book by Tara Brach. It is a valuable tool at any time in our Vipassana practice. When difficult emotions arise, this practice can be really a powerful ally to help us be in healthy, insight-oriented relationship with whatever is present. Insight-oriented relationship is what we're after. So let me just briefly, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, let me just briefly explain what RAIN stands for. So the R of RAIN stands for recognition. So with recognition, we step out of denial, and the process or the first thing we have to do is to name and inwardly bow to our experience. So we can literally say to ourselves, ah, sorrow, here you are again. Now here's excitement. Here's conflict. And again, here's sorrow. Maybe it's tension that you recognize. And of course, there's pain. We always know when we're struggling with pain or discomfort. So we recognize these rising phenomena of feelings or ideas or thoughts or ruminations that come into our mind while we practice. Jack Kornfield says that recognition moves us from delusion and ignorance toward freedom. A in RAIN stands for acceptance. Acceptance is sometimes the hardest part of dealing with difficult situations or with difficult emotions. But accepting the feeling allows us to relax and really open to the facts, the reality that is before us. Acceptance refuses to fight reality. I love the saying, you can fight reality all you want, but in the end, you're going to lose that battle every single time. There's a Zen saying that I love. It says, if you understand, things are just as they are. And if you don't understand, things are just as they are. So that's kind of the state we're getting, wanting to get to, that things are just as they are. You must accept that. Now, we're not being asked to condone negative feelings or negative circumstances or injustices. We're just being asked to recognize that they're present and then accept them as a part of rising phenomena in consciousness. In recognition and acceptance, we recognize our dilemma and accept the truth of the whole situation. Ideally, we may not always do that, but that's ideally what we're striving for. From that standpoint, then, we have a better chance of making wise decisions and being discerning. I stands for investigation. Buddhism, as you all know, teaches that whenever we are stuck, it is because we have not looked deeply enough into the nature of the experience that we're having. The Buddha gave us a strategy for investigation in the four foundations of mindfulness: mindfulness of body, feelings, mind, and dharma, the underlying principles of experience. We investigate whether we are clinging, resisting, or simply letting things be, and we determine then if the experience or the thought or the feeling is causing suffering or happiness. Is it pleasant or unpleasant? From there, then, we hope to move into better discernment around the situation that we're examining. And finally, the N of RAIN stands for non-identification. We come to see how much we are identified with our suffering or our joy. How attached are we to it? How much does it determine our sense of self? We stop taking experience as me or mine, and we show how our identification creates dependency, dependence, and anxiety and inauthenticity. We inquire into every state of being. Is this who I really am? Is this what I really want? And we let go and rest in self-awareness. This reducing the seemingly ongoing struggle of being a human being can happen through rain. Now, I must just say before I go on that Tara Brach, some of you, I know there are a lot of Tara Brach fans out there. Tara Brach has adapted McDonald's acronym, and she calls the N nourishing, using this last step not so much as a dealing with self or self-identification, but she's more interested in using it as a form of nourishing or self-compassion in the struggle that we're going through as we move through rain. So you've got a couple of options there in dealing with the N. So that's rain. It's very simple. There's lots and lots that's been written about it, and we could go talk in much more depth about what the meaning of each one of those letters is. But I thought, I kind of decided as I was anticipating this talk that I wanted to give a really good example of how one can use rain and struggle with it. And I thought, what better way to do that than to read a section from my journal wherein I am quite often dealing with rain and trying to approach and think about my own practice and my own experiences in practice. Just a sidebar here and a shout out for some of you who maybe don't use journaling as a as a part of your practice. I'm a writing teacher, so I'm sort of inclined to use writing as a tool in just about every aspect of my life. And the journal that I keep every morning after I do my meditation has been enormously helpful to me in thinking about my practice and thinking about the issues and ideas that I'm struggling with through my practice. So tonight, I'm a little bit nervous about doing this, you guys, because it's a vulnerable thing to do to read from your journal, which remember is not edited. It's not a formal essay. It's not a, in-depth description or summary of rain. It's a personal self-exploration that comes from my own writing experience. So here's the journal entry that I did several days ago. In January, I will move out of a home I've lived in for 23 years and into a very small apartment in the Mayflower here in Orlando or in Winter Park, which is a retirement community. The ramifications of this move have been profound for me and multivarious and given me the opportunity to examine myself, to consider what I am to do as my experiment on this planet progresses, and to take advantage of what Peter says is an opportunity to reinvent myself. I have to say, when he said that to me, reinventing myself, I was enthralled because I'm 79 years old and I never really anticipated reinventing myself in the last 10 years of my life. Let's hope I have 10 more years. But still, I was so taken by that statement that he made to me. Who wouldn't be a little bit interested at the thought of reinventing oneself. So, with maybe 10 good years of living left in me, how do I make decisions about how I will move through My last years, my fifth season, as is off it is often called. To begin, I will tell you this: I have jumped enthusiastically into the process of Swedish death cleaning. Some of you may be familiar with that book, which has, risen and fallen on the New York Times best-selling books over many years. It's a book about preparing to die and preparing and dealing with all the stuff that we've accumulated in life that we may not want to leave to our families or our children, our friends to have to deal with. And that is exactly where I am right now. I'm in the midst of going through my house that I live in right now is not that big, but believe me, I have crammed every nook and cranny and corner and shelf and built-in that I could possibly add into this house. I've crammed them all full. I'm a very skillful organizer. And I'm quite overwhelmed these days in going through this process of death cleaning. That was a little sidebar. Okay, now back to the journal. The death cleaning began with my bookshelves. I am a teacher, a scholar, and a person who has lived through books her entire life. And I spent most of yesterday going through books and putting those books to sell or give away into boxes. It was good to see things going away, but for the most part, to be really honest, this was a really, really difficult task for me. One that is not even close to being finished because I just went through one category of books, and there are several categories of books in my library. So first, I culled all the coaching, creativity, and lifestyle books that I have collected over the years and used in my coaching and teaching in my encore career as a creativity coach at Life Art Studio. Hundreds of books in this category, mostly hardbound, because I cannot wait for a new book to come out in paperback. And it was nice to see the range of books as I went through them all and pulled each one out, opened them up, looked at the markings I had made in that the quality, it was just fun to see the quality of thinking and writing that I have collected in those books. And it made me proud to have been such a well-read guide for my clients. I was always quick to give reading advice to them and eager to show my protocol. I was always eager to show that my protocol was based in good, sound research and sound thinking. I was proud of these books. I was maybe even prideful about these books, but they had to go. I am not a coach any longer, and that version of my life was really wonderful for a while. I loved every minute of it, but there simply is not room for a library in my new tiny home. And I am already mourning the loss of these books, which is part of what happens when you go through a Swedish death cleaning process. To soothe myself, I ask myself, will you ever use them again, Leslie? Will you read these books again? And the answer is probably not. So why keep them? And still, I was pained to think of letting them go, even though they have become mere decoration in my home in the last few years. I like that kind of decoration, though, I say to myself. It represents me in the highest form, a person dedicated to the good, the true, and the beautiful, to living life fully and happily, and to understanding how the mind works to facilitate that kind of living. I learned so much from these books, and I did good work in this world because of them. In no way could I have been a teacher or a coach or a mentor without them. They have given me vision and perspective, knowledge and insight, creativity at times, and maybe, if I'm lucky, at some point in the far future, within 10 years, hopefully, maybe they have given me a smidge of wisdom, but wisdom is not for me to determine about myself. Anyway, it is clear that most of these books have to go. There simply is not room for them in my new space. I repeat over and over to myself. But here comes the other side of my brain that says, but how can there not be room for things that so define you, Leslie? Things that have made you what you are, things that have served you so well in this lifetime. These are the questions that face me immediately upon waking the morning that I started this process. And then, as I made coffee, I realized non-self. Oh no, don't misunderstand. I did not fully grasp non-self after years of questioning this enigmatic idea. Non-self, I question it so much. How can there be no self when it seems that I feel selfness so profoundly almost all day long? But I'm thinking, and this is the way it often works for me in the study of these complex ideas, I'm thinking maybe I got a little bit closer this morning as the coffee maker gurgled its way to completion of its task. I saw how these books have become markers of me, a part of what I am. Maybe I could even call them props for me thinking that I am a person interested in and somewhat knowledgeable about serious topics. That's a thought that makes me feel good about myself. These books, I thought, are the maps of that quest to know what myself is. They are the indicators of my curiosities over many years. They show me who I have been and how I have developed. They are maybe, I don't know, throw this out there, representatives of myself. I am the kind of person who reads books. It's a label I'm very attached to, I came to see in the process of this culling. They are a history of my mind travels. They show me to be a person dedicated to literature, to the arts, to philosophy, to creativity, to spirituality, to Buddhism, to order and life management, to cooking, to gardening, to painting, and to taking courses of all sorts over the years. If I don't have these books around me, how, really, how am I going to possibly remember all of the quests that I've taken? In these books, I see the territory I've traveled for decades. And just as important, how will others see that territory if I get rid of these books? So there's a lot of self management going on here, right? So back to the journal. They say the map is not the same thing as the territory. You may have heard that phrase before. I first learned that phrase from Richard Wilbur, or not Richard,
Ken Wilber.
Ken Wilbur, thank you. Ken Wilbur, whose work I have followed closely over the years. But it was actually the Polish-American philosopher whose name is Alfred Korzybski who coined the phrase, the map is not the territory. He used this concept to explain that our perception of reality is the map, and it is not the same as reality itself, which is the territory. Our understanding of the world is limited by our senses and experiences, so the mental models we create are always an abstraction of a complex reality. Thank you, Dr. Korzybski. I really like that statement. But I'm wondering, does that apply here? The map is not the territory. I don't think so, my little brain said. In this case, these maps are the territory, the concrete indicators of a certain kind of mind and a distinct being with distinct yearnings and aspirations. If I sell these books or give these books away and they become scattered out there in the world, separated from one another, the map falls apart. It is no longer a map. It is discrete bits of data strewn to the wind. My little heart was just aching at the thought of it, leaving me bereft of their reminder of who I have been and what I've become, and maybe even what I have accomplished in some small part. Pridefulness rears its ugly head as I look at all the boxes. Pridefulness. It's not easy to say that out loud about yourself. I know this sounds completely egotistical, like my little mind is of any importance in the big scheme of things. I know it's not, and yet I confess to this confusion of feelings. And you can see that they are causing me to suffer. They have put me in a defensive mode in this writing, and my defense is undoubtedly flawed. The good news is, my investigation of the pain I was feeling as I culled my stacks has helped me see that I have constructed a self that pleases me in its literary forays. In waiting for the coffee to brew, I understood how deeply attached I am to that version that I've created of myself. Maybe even desperately attached to it. These books have distinguished me from the madding crowd. They have been markers of my curiosities over decades. They are announcements of the kind of person that I am. If they go away, will I still carry in me their knowledge, their wisdom, their insights, and understanding of how the world works, little pieces of it, little pieces of understanding. The fear, obviously, is I fear that it won't do that, that it will not, it will be lost. The first taste of coffee is a jolt for me. It is clear that I'm believing these books represent me. This is the first step of rain. I have crafted a self-image and become attached to that self-image. Do I fear that part of me will go away when they go away? Yes, indeed, I do. That is exactly what I fear. Otherwise, how will people know, or how will I know that I've been a good student all my life, that I've read widely, given my meager capacities? It's all relative, right? But I have, for my meager capacities, read widely, and that I have endeavored to pursue important ideas. I know I repeat myself, guys. Repetition is the habit of attachment. Repetition is the habit of attachment. The investigative process leads me to ask, and why, dear Leslie, is that so important to you? What would you be like if you dropped this particular marker of who you have been? And if you drop these markers, if they go away as they must, do you think that the qualities they have fostered in you will go away too? And the answer to that question is yes, that's exactly what I fear. Yes, I guess that's what I'm fearing, that that knowledge will go away and I will be a cipher. Silent and unremarkable. But then, I say, isn't that okay? Silent and unremarkable might not be so bad, right? You could write about how unremarkable you are. That made me laugh. Yeah, I could write about how unremarkable I am. In fact, I could create a whole new self that is completely unremarkable. But there's the possibility that you might continue to find yourself remarkable in the way your mind, body, spirit travels through experience quite naturally, with gentle curiosity. That quality, I am convinced, about me will not go away. even if the books go away. Peter asked the question, what would it be like to be unburdened by the person you used to be? We've heard him say this phrase many times, and oh my gosh, it's such a provocative question, and a question I might well spend more time with. What space might be opened if you weren't that well-read self? If you weren't that diligent student? If you no longer were a seeker? What would happen if you weren't lugging these books and these attachments around as your representatives in the world? What would it be like to be without them, to just be? The answer might be you would be a presence instead of a container. I have acquired things as markers of a self that the Buddhists say does not exist. Clothes, art, cooking utensils, matchboxes, books, cleaning supplies, and more stuff than any one human on earth deserves to possess. Wise men say you are not your possessions, but I have been acting almost my entire life as if they were a pretty good stand-in for me. But think about all the work that is required to maintain these possessions, Leslie. What would you do with all the time you use spending maintaining, organizing, and displaying things for the world to see? How would you fill that space, that time? Maybe the self is just that. It's space. It's space. It's not a container to be filled with beautiful things. There are no firm edges. It's a space in time, a moment of awareness, of presence, and it's here only for a nanosecond. What would it look like to spend the next 10 years in that space? What would it feel like to spend the next 10 years in that space? Do you really want to read about that space? Or do you want to experience that space? So I've been studying non-self for years, asking questions about it, worrying about it, confused by it, frustrated by it. Even the desire to understand non-self has become a characteristic that I cherish and cultivate, I'm quite ashamed to say. What would it take for you to let that go? What is the fear of letting that go? Can you imagine that it could be good or remarkable even, to let that go? I have said that I am going through Swedish death cleaning, and you can surely see that it has unnerved me. It's hard trying to get your material life down to a very, very small footprint on this earth. But that's what I'm wanting to do. Maybe I need to reframe this whole process and say, in addition to going through Swedish death cleaning, I am simultaneously going through a self-cleaning. Rain is a process for doing this. And I hope that you see in this journal entry that I just read a record of rain practice. It is messy. It is back and forth. It is confusing at times, and it doesn't always go in a linear pattern of the acronym itself. Recognize, accept, investigate, and then step into non-identification. That's the order in which it can be worked through, but it doesn't always, for me, obviously, as you can see in this writing, it doesn't work in that linear fashion always. I'm going to talk more about rain on December 10th when I come before this group again. But to conclude, I would like to leave you with a poem, as I often do. This poem is by Karen Mizen Miller, who is a Buddhist author. And Peter, can you, is it easy for you to make me a co-host so I can screen share something?
Let me see.
Did it happen?
No, I'm still
No.
trying to figure out how to do
Okay.
it.
I'll just read it. I thought for me, when I hear poetry, it helps me if I can actually see it, but I'll read it slowly. Karen Mizell Miller is the name of the poet, and the poem is called I Knew You Before. I knew you before you were a victim, before you were a wreck, a mess, and a bomb, without a crowning success or crippling failure, before you had an issue, an axe, or a cross. No disorder, no syndrome, no label, undiagnosed, without a blemish or scar. Before that night and the morning after, before the after and before the before, before the fall, the crash, the crime, without an upgrade or a makeover, version 0.0. No story, no narration, no closed captioning, no footnotes, and no bonus features before you remembered to forget and forgot to remember. I knew you before you were what you say you are, what you think, what you fear, what you know. Do you know yourself before? I hope that was resonating with you in the light of the journal entry that I read. So now we've got plenty of time for questions or comments or, anything else you'd like to ask about with the process of rain? Steve Perlman?
Hey Leslie, that was really good. And I'm going to post a PDF link. This is by Tara Brach. It's just a single page that she put into a PDF on her description of rain.
Great, thank you.
But what I'd like to discuss, because I think these things are so fascinating, and I've had the opportunity to just sift through 100 years of family history, and from both of my branches, my mother and father's stuff, my grandparents, and the more I go through that, I'm able to just contemplate what life was like in a just such a very different time period. I mean, if this stuff was gone, I would never be able to do that. But I can actually not only contemplate what that was for them, but how through their experiences, as those affected the family members that I've had experience with, that I see the connection in how I've formulated things through those experiences with them and their experiences before that, as they were also growing up. I mean, these are all these experiences are what accumulate into, I guess what's good and bad, right? If we wish to judge that, but it's there. It's there, and it and it affects us, and it's just part of us. It's part of us, and it's just lovely to be able to actually see those threads of what they were and of how I was affected by that over time.
Steve, are you suggesting that I keep my books?
Well,
Making me feel bad for
books
getting
are
rid of my
books. I
books.
mean, I've got a ton of that stuff also. But without them, no one else sees those threads of what those were. But the threads go way beyond just those collections of books, right? It
Yeah.
goes way back.
Yes.
And very broadly too.
Is important that that history be, just recovered. You never know who eventually sees these things and what they actually get from that. The insight, right? The insight, the recognition of your own patterns, good and bad, whatever you are from those experiences. Or as in your poem, what it was when you were at 0.0, right? And the things that you can't possibly put together in that web of rich experiences that you had early.
Yeah. I think that you I agree with you, and I have a friend I speak with every Sunday morning who is 93 years old, and she is totally caught up in her family legacy, re researching it all the way back to what thousand, not thousands, hundreds of years ago. And she's, it bothers me to hear her do that because, unlike you, who it sounds to me like you're looking at these pictures or this material from your family as a way to understand the way they lived or how different it was from the way you live. That's one thing. I guess kind of what I am seeing, then if I had a lot of money and a big house, believe me, I'd keep all these books because you never know. As soon as I throw these books away, there's going to be one in there that I'm going to need for a talk I need to give or for something I want to talk about with a student or whatever. But I think you're, I hear what you're saying and I agree with what you're saying. What I'm trying to dig out in that writing, that very rough writing that I did, is where does it go over the line and become self-identification?
Always.
Yeah. So that's kind of what it what worked out for me. And I certainly don't want to begrudge anybody from doing research and history and gathering family data. I think that's interesting that people do that. I personally have no interest at all in doing that. And I do have a lot of interest in trying to figure out how I've constructed a self. You know, what are the tools and experiences that I've used to make myself or try to make myself?
Yeah, I want to say something about that last part of the acronym, non-self or nourishing, because that really intrigued me when I heard you talk about that. I think one of the things you've been talking about is the price we pay for the identities that are, fabricated. About a learned person or a teacher or an American
Yeah.
or a baby boomer or whatever. All of those, they come with a price, and the price is distress and confusion because we're either striving to feed, back to the nourishing part, feed the self that's never satisfied, or to nourish the process of letting go of that. And when I say letting go of that, it's not so much letting go of the books, but letting go of the felt need to define yourself by
Yes.
how you've been conditioned. How you've been
Yes.
conditioned as a reader, how you've been conditioned as a writer, how you've been conditioned as a teacher. And the list is enormously broad of all
Yes.
the different karmic loads that we had imposed on us throughout the course of life. And one of the things that I'm so grateful for about this path is it gives me a different way to understand how that process plays out and not be quite so burdened with, having to have a certain identity
Yeah.
to let go of the bookworm or to let go of whatever.
Exactly. And it doesn't always even mean that you have to dismiss them. It's just it all comes back to attachment. If you're
Cost benefit
unhealthy,
analysis basically
yeah,
make it
exactly.
more materialistic that
Yeah.
you
And
invest in a particular identity. Okay, how much does that cost you?
exactly. And I just could write a whole book about experiences in my life where I've found myself trapped in a certain identity that eventually became burdensome to me and annoying and exhausting. And so I guess, you know, to me, part of what RAIN is all about really is not judging these things, but rather, learning the appropriate distance from them and perspective and discernment and letting go as much as you can. I mean, I'm not going to be, I don't want to get rid of all my books, but I still use a whole lot of my books. It's not like all of them are mere decoration, but when you have as many as I have now, a lot of them are. And and to go back to what Steve was saying, they're part of my history. Like I have my textbooks that I used as an undergraduate English major. Oh my gosh, you can't throw my Chaucer away. You know, it's just ridiculous. Am I going to read Chaucer again? No, I'm not going to do that. But by God, I've got the book and I could if I wanted to. So I think that's the unraveling that I'm doing, and it's challenging.
Yeah, I've got also just this history now of all these books, even books that are written in German or written in German to teach them English. But they're kind of fascinating. But yeah, I can see that. Okay, well, if I can't let go of the attachment, then, I'm trapped by that. Still,
Right.
I can at least recognize that they had the intent of passing it on, and I can go ahead and separate this stuff out so that it doesn't just get dumped, but rather in respect to that history, pass that on
Yeah.
in.
See, there's your discernment right there. That's really good, Steve. That's a really, I think you've really come to a good place with it all. Keep it in perspective. Right view is important here. I think, Marty, you have a comment or a question?
Hold on just a second. Let me lower my hand here. I appreciate you sharing what you did. And I am a book lover too. I have way too many books, but I think that listening to you, one of the things I heard is like, I just want to throw them away. And I think what Stephen was alluding to is like, I think if you can rehome them, think about it, that is like you're helping to pass on.
Oh, yes.
Pass on that, like finding the right home for it.
Yeah, that's good, Marty. It's really true. It's like a passing on your legacy. When I quit working, when I quit teaching at Rollins, I gave all of my pedagogical books to my graduate students. They were thrilled to get these because they're all poor. They can't, they're in graduate school. They can't. It's expensive to be a graduate student in English. And
And
so,
books are valuable. I mean, they're
yeah.
really very valuable. And I'm sure there's some people that would, I don't know, like what titles you have. You said you have hardbacks of everything. I'm sure
Well,
there's a wealth of knowledge in there that you're sharing with somebody, and you just have to
yeah.
find the right place for them is probably,
Absolutely.
Now, also, when Paula and I,
And I
my wife and I, both retired psychotherapists, and when we retired, Paula was is an alumni of Rollins in the psych department, psychology department. So we took a bunch of our books that we used professionally, gave them to that
Yeah,
Rollins
it's a
graduate.
good thing to do. Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like a sense of loss. It was a celebration.
Yeah.
Look, this is great. Look, these people, look what these people will get from this. We got so much from it. Look what they'll get from it.
Yeah, I think here's another place that the Dharma has helped us, right effort. I spend a lot of time talking thinking about right effort these days because I really want to reframe, instead of thinking of this as a loss, to think of this as a joyful thing that I got the what a miracle that I had the life that got that allowed me to indulge myself in this passion and to share that passion with others. So yeah, I think that's thank you for that, Marty. I think that's a good point. So, I think Susan has a Marty, did
I
you have
also have a
another?
comment. No,
Okay,
I
thank you.
was, I
Thank
just,
you. So we'll go with Susan and then with looks like Sharon wants to say
Karen,
something. Susan?
sorry, my camera's not working at the
No
moment. I had
worries.
to
No
switch
worries.
computers, so apologies. I added to the chat the link from Michelle McDonald's version of Rain, and she has also added the second half, which is Drop.
Yes, that's my next talk.
So I've added the link to the group in Hawaii she works with for folks to look at if they want to look at it. But first, I wanted to say thank you. That was incredibly brave for you to read, and as always, I am impressed with your willingness to share vulnerable things with groups. Also, I have discovered we're not the same age, but we've had similar experiences, right? Where I definitely was my position. I identified as whatever title I had and whatever job I had. And when I decided to totally switch careers, all of a sudden it was like, wait, who am I? When I took a step down from academics and went back to corporate, and just wanted, and in my interview said, I just want to be an individual contributor. I mean, I had been dean of grad studies and moved over. That took a little while for the ego to be placed in check and go,
yes,
yeah, you're not running the graduate world anymore. It's okay. You don't have to. And now that I opted to retire early, you know, the first, it's been 5 months that I look back and go, well, number one, I've been busier than I ever thought I would be.
Yeah.
But number two, you know, for the first couple of months, it was like, well, who am I? And what is myself?
Yes.
And it's been really interesting doing RAIN and finding, you know, what's my next step? And what does that mean? And how does that tie in? And where is it peaceful and right action and right speech? And how can I balance life? So this was very much needed tonight. So thank you.
Well, Susan, you're so welcome. And believe me, I'm going to use you in December the 10th, because Susan is right now in a teacher training program and she's doing a lot of group work. And what I want to talk about in December is going into the protocol a little bit deeper
mm-hmm.
about how you actually would do this with a partner
mm-hmm.
or within a group. And Susan is right in the midst of doing this. So
yes,
be prepared, Susan.
Yes, I will. I would most happily assist in whatever way you need.
Yes,
but it is, it is an intriguing practice. And while at times the in is nurturing or nourishing is helpful, depending on the recognition and such of whatever it is that's going on, the not self, I'm finding much more valuable right now.
Yeah.
Just given my current situation in life and such. So thank you for this. This was quite wonderful.
Great. Thank you, Susan.
And something else came to mind for me about this kind of accumulation of things that build an identity.
Yes.
And those are the things that we get attached to as an identity that are unpleasant, dysfunctional, self-defeating, that they can become things that in a weird sense we kind of treasure and nurture.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's hard to let that go.
Yeah. Like being the victim. We've all had people in our lives who've just taken on that role of victimness and cultivated it quite intensively. Yeah. Sharon, did you have a question or a comment?
Oh, well, I have a whole lot of you've stirred up a lot of stuff in your talk, and everybody else's comments, Steve, and all of the other comments have been very meaningful. And I am a retired librarian. So when you're talking about books, I know very well that experience of the meaningfulness of books. And I want to kind of touch on that a little bit, because what Steve was talking about, I think, is really interesting. And I have a similar parallel with family stuff that I am more interested in, or I became more interested in as I aged. And I'm kind of behind you a couple of years, Leslie. So you are actually teasing out a lot of things that are niggling in my in my existence here. This is the longest I've ever lived in one place. And I have to stop and reflect, because I'm in the late 70s. I'm a couple of years behind you, but I got to tell you, 30, let's see, I've been here 28 years, almost 30 years, and I've never lived in one place this long, or even close to this long, which is pretty remarkable. Moving about caused me to evolve and deal with things. You know, when you're making major moves, you say, I don't want to take this with me. I don't want to, you know, space and all of that stuff. But My life is really different now, and I can reflect on things, and I can see things as a sort of a two-sided coin. From a two, there's like two sides to everything, and I'm trying to stay in the, you know, find the middle way in my life, in everything, and I have to put it through a filter, more or less, of what is, you know, in the middle of, not too extreme in one area, or, you know, not too far over in the other area. And there are different strategies and ways to, I know people, I've talked with people over the years about archiving things, you know, like digitizing them, or, you know, and of course there are books like, who is it, Marie Kondo, the yeah. one who says, you know, everybody probably knows about her, I can't even think of the title, but, you know, people who've dealt with, and there are even TV programs about the legacy, where people go into people's homes to determine what's valuable to their, let's say, family members, their, you know, like they're downsizing, and what is it that's really important. And I think that's interesting to see how people make those decisions as far as importance. And that right. is very, extremely subjective. Now, the thing that concerns me is memory. And I have boxes and boxes, and I don't have, you know, like a lot of kids. I don't have kids. So, like, who wants this stuff? I have slides, and the technology has changed. I've traveled and lived in places that have vastly changed, and places I've forgotten I've even been. And I've experienced things that very few people have experienced. And this is all pre-internet, and this is all hard for me to even think about. But I don't want to get too deep into that, but I have a hard time thinking about tossing these things. But my memory's not as good. I could probably look at pictures and think, now, when did I take, where is, you know, because if you don't label things right away, yeah, it may or may not be what I think. And it takes up a lot of time to right. even to go through these things. And do I want to spend my time doing that? Well, I do it in a haphazard way. And I haven't downsized.
Memory becomes another thing, like a book. We don't want to give our memories away. We don't want to lose our memories. But we do, don't we?
We want to?
No, we don't want to. We don't want to let go of our memories. You know, they're like
books. It's a clinging. Is what you're saying is a clinging.
That's right.
It becomes a burden, the memory?
Yes. Just having an identity associated with the memory. Whether it's an unpleasant memory or pleasant memory, there's, you know, there's craving and clinging involved in both cases. So letting go of them, you know, a book is not just, you know, a physical object. It's all the memories that are associated with it. So, I mean,
I started to write when people had urged me, people had said, you should write a book about this. And I know people who think that my life has been remarkable when they really hear me talking about things that I've done, and when they kind of express that to me, then I become like, oh yeah, I guess it is remarkable. I didn't consider it. I actually didn't cling in the way that you're describing, because I didn't regard it. That was my life.
We all cling in our own particular way.
Well, I'll just say it was my life, and it was my experience, and it was all okay. Then I was not living in it, because when I came back and to America and I continued my life, I was very busy in this life, and I was very busy in the present moment, whatever, whenever that was. So everything evolved, everything moved along, and I was kind of thinking, I was a little sort of humming in my head, to every thing, turn, turn, turn. There's right. a season, you know.
Turn,
turn, turn, turn.
We're running over our time tonight, dear. So.
I know. And you and you are going to remind me that I can stop right here. So yeah. I would love to continue to discuss this with anybody who's interested because I really think it's got a lot of it's pithy. It's very pithy.
Yes. So thank you very much, Leslie, for your presentation. Do you have any final comments to kind of put a cap on it?
No, I just well, yeah, maybe I do have. I say this for myself as much as for you guys, but I really do find that the element of non-identification is such a rich area for exploration as we've been doing for years here at OIMG. I just think it's not to, we're not doing, it's a fine line between analysis. You can, as Peter, as you said, you can get into analysis paralysis, but we'll continue. I'll come back to this in my talk on the 10th, but I just find it really important to work through this process with a really good guide who has the capacity to sort of watch for when you go off, slide off into story. And that's, of course, what we do all the time. But, you know, coming back and really asking the core questions that the protocol asks of us is really getting at the three characteristics of existence: suffering, impermanence, and non-self. So that's my final word.
Right. Thank you. It's our custom at the end of our meetings for us to sit in silence together, peacefully. So let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well. Hope we're all reasonably safe and happy till the next time we have a chance to chat.